Brothers and sisters, welcome. Hello. It's very good to be here with you all at the convention, whatever it is, Area Order Weekend, sorry. Actually, this is the second of two things that I've been attending. I've just come from Hridaya Bija. You may or may not have heard of it. A cheer. I hear a cheer. It's a forest garden that's been developed by Sagaravadra. And I can't... We spent 2 days there, three days really, and I can't describe its richness and its beauty. It's a forest garden where all the plants are edible. And not all of them, but you know what I mean. And it's come from his inspiration and his journey. And it's just so refreshing and renewing to be there. The bounty, the plenitude, the beauty of the place makes you feel good just to inhabit. And I was there with my friends from people I was ordained with in 1992. There were 10 of us, and it was our 25th order anniversary. 25 years. And that's half the life of the order as we're coming up to our 50th anniversary. But we were just in the... And for some of you, 25 years may sound an incredibly long time. Some of you probably just come from Guhyaloka or Akashavana, and the perspective of someone who's been ordained for that long may seem incredibly ancient to you. And I think that's worth just acknowledging that there are different perspectives. So I'm going to be speaking from a member of that generation. And of course, there are people of a much older generations than me. I was talking to my good friend Mahamati, who just celebrated his 40th anniversary in the order. So half the life of the order. But what was the heart of it for me, that event with my friends from 92? There were 10 of us. Actually, there are 26 of us ordained. Three deaths, three resignations, six people in Australasia or Mexico and they couldn't make it. Some other people didn't want to come, maybe, I don't know. Other people just didn't work out, the dates and so on didn't work out. So there were 10 of us. And everyone had been on a journey in their time in the order. And that was the heart of it. We told the story, not of 25 years, we took it from the last time we had one of those gatherings, which was when we'd been ordained for 10 years, so the last 15 years. But they were very strong stories because they touched very strong experiences, including my own. So we were the 10 who came. I think most of the others would have come if they could have. We were still here, still engaged with the order. Some people have taken very big responsibilities as chairman, as preceptors. Some of them still had them. One person recently became a chair of a big centre. and also many changes. I mean, for myself, you know, if I go back to 2002, I was living at Majjhimaloka. I was working with Subhuti and others there. Now I have no responsibilities whatsoever, said smiling at the public preceptors. I have a family, I'm father, I have a semi-detached house in suburbia. And a theme emerged, not from everyone, there's a range of experiences, but a strong theme was the theme of people having a crisis, hitting a wall is the phrase that seemed to be used most. When their ideas of what it was to practice ceased to work for them. So Sagravajra, I'll just say a little bit, and actually he's going to give a presentation about his experience on Sunday, so he can speak for himself. But he was he's a very wholehearted person, and he says he spent 16 years of the last 25 in what he calls a wilderness, where he simply didn't know what to do in terms of his Dharma practice. That's a long time in the wilderness, not quite up there with the children of Israel, but not bad. And Hridayabija does feel rather like the promised land, although I don't want to caricature it. And he and others talked about having a map at the early stages of their time in the order, having an idea about who they were, what their lives were, where they were going, and then finding themselves in a territory where there was no map, and they didn't know what to do, and they considered resigning. Quite a few people had considered resigning because the Dharma, as they'd learnt it, didn't seem to be working for them. Disillusionment, in some cases, which is an interesting word because it implies illusions that are then lost. Crises of faith, which is another interesting phrase because it implies faith. And in quite a number of cases, not in every case, that was connected with Bante, with a loss of confidence in Bante. In some cases, it was connected with accounts, stories of his past sexual activity, and so on. Some people, you know, had been running centers or something like that, and then all this stuff comes up. And we're talking now the previous crisis that we went through, which was in 2003, 2005, and how difficult that made it for them, and just all sorts of problems. I'm not going to try and capture those, because everyone's experience is different, and it's not really possible to sum it up. So I'm trying to evoke it, and I hope you're getting a sense of the power of those stories and the mystery of how some of those people, most I'd say, had found a way to practice that felt like it was authentic for them, that was their own, that they could attest to, that spoke to them. It was their own map, if map is the right metaphor, because for some people, the map was about having no map, not needing a sense of progress. For Sagravajra, the practice is getting his hands in the earth and creating beauty. So this was a very rich experience of hearing these people with whom, and we all felt a very strong sense of connection with each other, even though we're very different as a group. And we felt that immediately, that when we met up together. And our experiences, that experience of a big crisis, a loss of faith, wasn't my experience. Personally, I don't think I had quite the same illusions when I was ordained. The first 8 years of my experience of Tri Ratna, and I did have illusions, was when I was a Mitra at the Croydon Buddhist Centre. And you've heard all the stories about what that particular experience was like. It actually, those stories are often correct. So when I was ordained, I didn't think it would all be sweetness, light, etc. And I'd understood that in Croydon, the light of idealism and belief in things like beauty and friendship and so on burned very bright, and the shadows were very dark. But I have changed, and I don't have those institutional responsibilities anymore. And I share that sense of lost innocence. And perhaps the fruits of experience. So we talked about ourselves, and we also talked about the order, of course. A lot of order members are talking about the order in a lot of contexts at the moment. And again, there was a range of views, a wide range. There were, I don't really want to characterise them. There were the issues that we've been talking about, which are to do with the past of the order and also to do with new practices coming into the order, prompt a range of responses. And those were there in our group. There was so much wisdom, so much richness, so much experience and maturity in the way that that group of order members discussed those, that I can't possibly summarise it. And I was reflecting, as we were having those discussions, that I was going to give this talk, and that I couldn't possibly express the subtlety, the nuance, and the dialogue that we were enacting as a group. Which then led me to ask what I was going to talk about. And I realised that what I needed to talk about was precisely that. That the wisdom is what we share and what comes from our dialogue. And that the way forward through these difficulties, through the questions we face, is going to emerge from that discussion if we know how to have the discussion. Having said that, I think I do need to qualify that. There was a lot of wisdom and maturity in that group. But personally, I found those discussions quite hard. In theory, I believe that what we need to bring to these discussions is curiosity, interest, respect, the capacity to listen. In practice, I find that quite difficult. I'm very good in writing, actually. If you can engage in an email dialogue with me, I'll be very, very considerate. But if you get me over the dinner table, I'll probably get into a bit of a rant. So that's my limitation, one of my limitations. I won't go over all the other ones. And that's part of it as well. Why is that? So I try to be curious about why I get tense when we have those discussions. What is it in me that feels under threat? What is it I need to defend? I think in my case, it's some kind of crazy belief that if there's a big problem, it's my responsibility to sort it all out. Leaves you feeling a bit tense, that one. Especially with this problem. So, I'm here to introduce or comment on the questions that we're going to be talking about in the groups, and I'll just mention them. I hope I'm not phrasing them wrong, by the way. What elements are essential and must be preserved into the future? And of all that we care about, what needs changing in our culture and institutions so we can continue responding to the cries of the world? Why me? Why am I standing here rather than someone else? I can't answer that question. Did I draw a short straw? Do fools rush in where angels fear to tread? Actually, it's worse than that. It's where women, men, and angels fear to tread. All I can say is that I've found myself reflecting on these issues over many years. And partly I was sort of forced to do that. I mean, my experience in Croydon made me do that. And then I found myself running the FWBO communications office when Madeleine Bunting wrote her article in the Guardian, and the FWBO files came out, and then I was working with Sabuti and others when Yesha Mitra wrote his article. So I found myself in the middle of all of that. And I'm not. Well, at least I clearly am. But I don't have a responsibility that puts me here. So we're having these discussions, and we've been here before. We have been here before. I have been saying that in a number of forums, and sometimes people don't like it. They disagree. Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I've heard the basic stories before, and I heard them told quite widely in 2003. We are hearing new testimonies, and those are important. They need to be honoured. They need to be heard. But I think they're more instances of what we'd heard before, on the whole. And not only have I been over this territory before, I feel it for whatever reason, and I think we all do. These questions about the flaws, the limitations, the shadows of the past, I feel it. And I sense that we all feel it. It's personal because it's about our lives. And all of us here have made a profound commitment to the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. So issues that affect the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order are very important for us. I tried to express this in 2003. By writing to someone called Norman Fisher. Now, he had survived, well, he'd been at the San Francisco Zen Center when they had quite a spectacular and cataclysmic, in a way, crisis of their own, which I won't describe. But he emerged from it as someone who commanded great respect for his wisdom, his sagacity, and his calm, his perceptiveness. I'd met him the previous year, and when all of the issues that we went through then blew up, I wanted to write to someone. I wrote a very heartfelt piece to him, and I really genuinely wanted to hear what he had to say. So I just want to read a little bit of what I wrote to Norman then, and a little later I'll come to something of how he responded. And this is really about the personal dimension. All these people, the critics, the doubters, the writers, the leaders, Sangharakshita and everyone else, had shared their lives for two or three decades. They had wound round each other and lived with each other and sometimes slept with each other. If these people weren't their lives, what were their lives? Sangharakshita's life had always seemed to take place somewhere above and beyond their own, in a misty land, signpost Dharma. But now, they weren't so sure that this country existed. He had started this Sangha, yet he had never fully been a member of it. What I meant by that was in the sense of participating in community life and working right livelihood business, that sort of thing. That must have been hard for him, and now it was hard for everyone. The order had a life of its own that valued honesty and openness so strongly that it couldn't not act from them and remain itself. That was wonderful, and in a way, it was tragic. They saw that for all their idealism, their practice had to start from reality. And they saw that, in the end, reality means people. Now, I'm not entirely sure about the metaphysics of that last sentence, but there's a poetic truth in that, the poetic truth being that we experience ourselves in relationship. And that was where we were in 2003. So one significant change in terms of where we are now, is Bhante's statement in January, in which he expressed his deep regret for all the occasions on which I have hurt, harmed, or upset fellow Buddhists, and ask for their forgiveness. So that is something Bhante hasn't said before, and it's very strong, very heartfelt, I think. And it relates to the kind of the sense of engagement or disengagement that I was talking about in that letter to Norman Fisher. And what does this mean for us? Talking about these journeys that we'd been on, those of us who'd been ordained together 25 years ago, and then talking about the order, there seemed a profound resonance between them. The journey from innocence to experience, which takes you through difficulty. It takes you through what the innocence has excluded. The shared idealism. One irony that really strikes me, looking back, because I've been around the movement for so long, I have a lot to look back on. How in the 80s, let's say, we talked about placing sex, in the 70s and 80s, let's say, putting sex on the periphery of the mandala. And how ironic it is that in so many of the discussions I now have about the movement in the 1970s, sex is right in the middle of the mandala. How perspectives change. Perhaps it's unwise to consider that something so potent and emotionally laden as sex can ever be on the periphery of our mandala and therefore the periphery of our awareness. I know that's not exactly what the phrase meant, but placing it on the periphery, it carries risks. And in that talk that Lokeshvara mentioned, Sangharakshita and the Shadow of the Past, I felt it was very important then to just name, acknowledge, recognize, realize, empathize with, feel that hurt, that harm, and that upset, which stemmed from actions based on an unrealistic and, I think, unwise viewpoint. And I also acknowledge that that issue magnetizes so many of the other troubles that we have in our lives, in our path through Dharma practice, in community living, in right livelihood, in families which are included or we feel excluded, in celibacy, in sex. Our ideas, the ideas that were theories 25 or 30 years ago, have been tested by our experience and sometimes tested to destruction. And that's inevitable, that's learning. Light casts shadows. And it's important that we look at what the shadows conceal, and essentially we do that by listening to each other. So again, to reiterate what I said in Cardiff, I made 3 points because they were the 3 things that I felt I could name. First point, Triratna is broken. The order is broken. Bhante is broken. And I do want to qualify that, actually. The second point, that the Dharma is alive in Triratna. And the third point, that I love Triratna. I love the order. And in a complicated way, I love Bhante. And those are intended to be taken together. So in saying that Triratna is broken, I was speaking from the heart, and I'm reluctant to lose the power of that statement. But it's been taken rather literally by some people, and Lokeshvara showed me what the dictionary said about the word broken. Smashed, shattered, burst, fragmented, rent, torn, and ruptured. So I think Maybe those would be a bit of an overstatement. I don't actually think that at all. But perhaps fractured or flawed. You know, so many of us have the experience of working in Buddhist centres. People come along, they're enthusiastic, they respond to the Dharma. They even respond to the Dharma as expressed by Bhante. And then we have that conversation with them, or they come across something on the internet, and that's the end of their involvement. So many people working in centres feel that, I think, well, the image of a fracture or a flaw, it's like pouring water into a jug, into a container. It's not that there's a hole in the bottom of the container, but there's a crack where things drip out the bottom. And this problem, this issue, is not going away. It affects people at all levels, right up to order members, chairs, college members. This has had a profound impact on the growth of the movement, on our influence on other Buddhist movements in the wider Buddhist world and the discourse around Buddhism, on Bhante's reputation, and so on and so forth. So I don't want to lose the impact of that statement, and ignoring these issues around Bhante and sex doesn't work. And it has been said over recent years, look, we've dealt with that, we need to move on from it. I don't think we can move on from it. That is what we need to learn. That's why I said Triratna is broken, meaning it's flawed. We will always be a movement whose founder had sex with his disciples in ways that many people considered to be unwise or even unethical intrinsically, but which have caused that hurt, that harm, and that upset. However magnificent we may be as an order, we will always be that order. And it's an existential problem for us because we don't have anyone else to fall back on. If you're a Buddhist, there are various Buddhist schools, numerous organizations and movements that have had numerous problems. When Trungpa Rinpoche died and then there was a whole series of problems after his death, well, there was the Kagyu lineage who kind of moved in to settle things down. Sugyal Rinpoche has recently stepped down. He's part of a much wider school, and other lamas have always been involved with his movement. Of course, it's very serious for them. But we don't have those other lamas. You know, it's Bhante. He separated himself from previous lineages. He started a new order. So it's existential for us. Those resonances between the journeys that we go on as order members and that the wildernesses that we find, the bardos we inhabit, and the movement, I think are very important. When I said broken, I meant broken pride, broken dreams, broken idealism. This is something that Norman Fisher expressed very well in talking about humility, the importance of humility. I'm going to read what he said about humility because he didn't really know Triratna, and yet it was very, very pertinent, and I think it still is. To me, the main message I hear in stories like this is the teaching of humility. We really don't ever know what we are doing. I'm just going to say that again, actually. We really don't ever know what we are doing. We're simply trying our best. We may be, probably are, overlooking something important. We must always keep that in mind and be modest and humble. Most of the great teachers who established Dharma in the West, Sangharakshita certainly among them, were not modest. The times were like that. We were all caught up in some grandiose vision of a new world, a new Buddhism, etc. And we thought we knew what we were doing, how it had been done wrong in the past. None of us were humble enough. And just to make the point, that's none of us, including Sangharakshita, but including everyone else as well. None of us were humble enough. We got stuck on the brilliance of our own viewpoints and the success of our missions. We need to be humble. We need to know that there's probably something we're overlooking. That was true in 1992, it's true now, and it's true of new practices and new approaches that come along saying that they are so much more potent and powerful and effective. Maybe they are. I'm not in any position to comment on that. But I also think we need humility. And we need humility about our own spiritual lives. Whether we feel we've broken certain fetters or not, whether we have broken those fetters, we need humility and the awareness that we may be overlooking something important. Secondly, the Dharma is alive in Sri Ratna. I know that in my bones. The reason I'm here is that the Dharma is alive in Sri Ratna. And over the years, as we share our lives, I've experienced such a substantial deepening of experience collectively, which I participate in to some extent. And that, I think, is the most important thing I know. It's a rare and precious thing in the world to find the Dharma alive, and we should tend it with care. Whatever criticisms we have, whatever disagreements we have, we should tend that flame of the Dharma with care. We must take great care that we don't do damage unwittingly. So, and I love Sri Ratna. I won't expound that. I've said enough. Except to say that I love Sri Ratna because the Dharma is alive in Sri Ratna, not because I have some kind of position, which I don't, or status, which is another matter, not because I've made such an investment in it. Although, no doubt, those things affect my feelings for Sri Ratna and my love in it, love for it. Really, it's because the Dharma is alive among us. So what do we want to preserve from the past? And that does mean asking, considering what's essential between us and what we share. Now, in my view, we can't depend on the latest statement that comes from the college to define that. They are written by committee, and I still help with those things sometimes. They are very difficult to write. There are such different voices in the college, and there are there's a fundamental unity between people, but it's writing by committee. We can't depend for understanding our unity on the latest paper that arrives in our email inbox and is 50 pages long, and most of us don't read. We can't depend on that. No one can redefine what the order is, not even Bhante. And I include in that his definition of the order as a community of disciples. He actually wasn't in a position to do that. All we can... I'll come back to that. No, sorry, I'm just getting a bit lost. Yeah, he wasn't in a position to do that. The language of discipleship implies a number of things which some people feel and some people don't feel. implies a sense of reverence, implies a sense of connection, and some people just don't feel that with Bhante. And it implies an absence of criticism. Can you be a critical disciple? Personally, I think you can, but I think if it's quite a tall order, and at the very least, that needs a lot of explaining and, I don't know, training or something. So implies a lack of criticism. And that's just simply unrealistic, given the range of responses that the order members have to Bhante, even order members, including order members, who are very committed to Triratna. And it also is unrealistic, given the experience of criticisms and the crises that those criticisms prompted. And by bringing in that language of discipleship, we were putting Bhante back into the separate space of the Dharma, in a different category from the rest of us. And that was inviting an equal and opposite reaction, which we have subsequently experienced. For that reason, I wrote to Bhante earlier this year, laying all that out. I put it slightly more politely, actually, but I laid it out. And he responded. We worked together, and the result was another statement by Bhante, which I think is significant, even though I've said we shouldn't be swayed by the latest statement. It was sort of withdrawing. It was a postscript, what he said in 2008, and was a corrective. I'm just going to read you what he said in that statement. You may know it, but you, then again, you might not, because it's just another email for many of us. And I think it's very important, and I think it needs to be registered, for example, on the ordination training processes. I know of order members who also share, this is what the statement says, I know of order members who also share and accept my understanding of going for refuge and the Dharma in the way I've described, for whom the term discipleship implies an unrealistically intimate, uncritical or reverential view of me. Therefore, taking account of such difficult differences, I have come to think that no single term, including the term discipleship, can adequately define the stance of all those who share my understanding of the Dharma and follow practices that flow from that understanding. So there's a sense of sharing understanding of the Dharma, but not using that word, discipleship, and not trying to replace it with another one. Bhante wasn't repudiating his role as a teacher. That's very important to him, and it has always been important to him long before he started using the word disciple. He still sees himself as a teacher, and I've been disappointed to see that some people have taken that statement as an implication that he is no longer saying he is a teacher for the order, or the teacher for the order. So what then is the basis of our unity? We're going to be discussing this, and I've already said that I think the wisdom is there in the discussion, not in someone like me standing here and trying to define it, lay it all out for us. And yet, I am going to say something, because this is, I think, something we could agree on. Maybe we'll find in our groups that this isn't the case. My view is that we can't rely on particular emotions towards Bhante, towards each other. We can't make any assumptions about what we might do or how we might live. Those things can't possibly be the basis of our unity. All we have, not exactly all we have, the fundamental thing we have is the promises that we make explicitly to each other and to our preceptors when we're ordained. The three refuges, the 10 precepts, and the 4 ordination verses of acceptance. That's what we need to keep coming back to, and what does that mean? And there's a context for that. We undertake the precepts, the refuge's precepts and the verse of acceptance in a certain context. And the context is, well, again, something we need to talk about and explore and discuss. What is that context? But Bante is part of it. I don't think we can, well, I think Bante is inescapably a part of that context. That for two reasons, really. Firstly, that's made very clear in the training process that leads up to ordination. And in that process, Bante's teaching is the shared framework through which we talk and cooperate and communicate. And secondly, because ordination is a witnessing, a recognition of another person's going for refuge. A recognition that they're going for refuge in the sense that the preceptor is going for refuge. In that sense, my ordination made me a part of a network of going for refuge. It connected me with my preceptor, with his fellow preceptors, and with Bante behind him. And being an order member means feeling my place within that network. That network of going for refuge, which starts with Bante and really rests on Bante. Not everyone agrees with this. I know that. I've recently had a very lengthy dialogue, which you are welcome to read, with another order member on the BuddhistCenter.com, on the thread section, on the thread called Sex and Insight, What Are We Really Discussing? Something like that. And, you know, a lengthy dialogue of many thousands of words in which myself and my interlocutor threw this backwards and forwards. And he's an order member of some standing, he simply doesn't agree that Bante has that place within our order because he has that place within our ordinations. I won't say who it is and I won't characterize his point of view because it's there online and you can read his words in his way, how he sees them. So I think, but I just want to acknowledge that it seems obvious to me, but others disagree. I recognize that. And that is a very profound discussion, a profound area of disagreement that we need to explore. Current relationship status with Bante, it's complicated. If we don't reject Bante, if we keep him there, and we also accept the criticisms which I'm making, and I acknowledge that some people aren't concerned about them. If we do, then it's complicated. And it's those complications that we need to work with. If we don't, then, well, it's very simple, really. We just excise Bante from our story. It's complicated. We can overstate Bante's role, and I think that's what the language of discipleship does, and we can understate it as well, in my view. We need to also be exploring what in Bante's teaching, what in our shared teaching, is central. I'm personally not convinced that Bante is really a systematic Dharma thinker. There are systematic elements, but I'm not entirely convinced, personally, of the efforts to make it into a system. I think he's a bit more whimsical and varied and inconsistent than that, which isn't a criticism. But one thing that for me is very important in Bante's approach and in Triratna's approach is balanced effort. Balancing the faculties of faith, wisdom, energy, concentration. That's what we do at our centres. We don't just do mindfulness or meditation. Or faith. I think in our debates about meditation, we're often impinging on these questions of balance. What's the balance between a directed approach to meditation and a undirected or formless approach to meditation? I hope we can see those things as a discussion about balance. When you're in motion, you are off balance. So we needn't be concerned when we have disagreements. But can we have that principle of balance that we is there in the range of practices that Bhante advocates in how we look at our disagreements? There are different styles of practice. When you are dancing or surfing, those are the things that give us our metaphors for balance. But even when you're walking, you are constantly going off balance and then adjusting. You need to keep your center of gravity low. You need to know when you're off balance, and when you fall, you need how to break, to know how to break your fall. Tri Ratna is a project. We're exploring together how the Dharma can flourish in this culture, how it can flourish in our lives. It's in motion, and we need, as order members, to take responsibility for our share in keeping that sense of balance, I hope, for ensuring that it really is the Dharma and that it really is alive. So we're going to be talking about this in groups, and no doubt we're going to be talking about this in many other contexts as well. Perhaps the important thing is how we talk, how we have those discussions, keeping our feet on the floor, breathing, staying open, staying true to what we've learned over our years as Dharma practitioners, hearing things from the past, hearing criticisms, hearing claims. Also, hearing people who don't share the criticisms. This process won't work if it's simply about giving the critics a platform and everyone else listening politely. Actually, I think we did that last time round. And it didn't work because the people who were listening politely were biding their time, waiting for it to die down. They need to be heard as well, or it won't be a dialogue. At Hridaya Bija, we talked a lot about the bardo, about not knowing, about the wisdom of not knowing. We talked about our lives, and we talked about poetry, and we talked about the Dharma. Line from Shakespeare. The mask is broken in the tempest. Prospero says, we are such stuff as dreams are made on. And our little life, our little lives are rounded by a sleep. And the line from the Bardo Tadal. When you're in the Bardo and you don't know, now is the time for energy and pure love.